A podcast of the cinema.
I was just voguing to our theme song.
And I was...
You were dabbing.
Dabbing. Because it's stupid.
We're good dancers.
We're very good dancers. You're Dave White.
You're Alonzo Duralde.
Right.
That we're film critics. Mm-hmm. This is our podcast of movies. We're married to each other. That's all the basic information that you need to know about
pretty
this
much,
podcast.
Yeah.
All our windows are closed because there's a gardener guy out across the street at the other apartment building making a chainsaw noise.
Making a ruckus.
And I don't know what they're chainsawing or snow blowing or something.
A cattywampus across the street?
There's a noise. I'm assuming it's not going to seep into this podcast, but then it might.
Anyway, if it does, you'll know why.
Yeah. This week is light.
It is, yeah. I think they just figured all the big Thanksgiving movies were still going to carry over because, you know.
And they have.
People were going to want another opportunity to see Allied and Rules Don't Apply, you know.
Yes.
Okay, maybe not those.
I did look at the box office mojo this morning because I had to find out what opened this week to see what I have to catch up on. You know, the first thing that happens when you open up box office mojo is the chart, the top 40 or whatever. It's just Moana.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, it's all about Moana.
Moana and Fantastic Beasts and, Allied. But not
Allied. People are going to see Allied, really?
No. Sorry, Arrival.
Yes. Okay.
Allied is the one that no one's going to see.
Yeah, well, more no ones are going to see, or fewer no ones are going to see the Warren Beatty movie.
I'm not saying people who go see Allied are no one. I'm saying that very few people are seeing Allied.
Right.
The weird thing is they show you how much the movie cost.
Mm.
On Box Office Mojo versus how much money it's made.
And you know the cost version on Box Office Mojo is like the polite, here's what we'll tell people.
Right.
We'll say it cost $180 million.
I don't follow the box office. But if I'm looking at the release schedule, like I go to Box Office Mojo every week, to look at the release schedule.
Yeah, they have a good calendar of what's coming out.
Once a month, that way you know what's coming out in case you have, for example, a film review podcast that you need to see movies for. And the... Hello, speaker that I have to turn down. Every once in a while, I do click on the chart to see... Because here's what I want to know. I want to know how much the tiny film that opened at Lemley is making.
Right.
Like, I want to know how... I remember earlier in the year...
How's Cemetery of Splendor doing?
That was the example I was about to give.
I knew it.
Earlier in the year, you know, I bought a ticket to see Cemetery of Splendor.
Mm.
Strand was only giving it out to critics. There was no Los Angeles press screening.
Right.
They were sending us out screener links on the internet. And I thought, there is no damn way.
You don't want to watch... Upachop Bong Virasethakul on your computer.
I'm not watching one of his films on my laptop. I'm simply not. They're screen events for me, and they're beautiful screen events that I need to see on as big a screen as possible. So I went to the Lemley, which has small screens, but still bigger than my laptop. I bought a ticket, and so I was actually tracking that film on Box Office Mojo to see how many screens nationwide it opened on, how much money it was making.
Where did you mentally subtract? If I hadn't bought a ticket, this gross would be $11 less.
Yes.
Of course.
When I went to a matinee, it was like $8.
Okay, fine.
Yeah. You know that movie tickets, I just saw this on the news this week, the average film ticket price nationwide now, they were talking about how expensive it is to go to the movies now.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what the average film ticket price is nationwide?
Like $8.
Sorry, I was taking a gulp of tea there. $8.61. So basically $9. That's okay.
Well, that's like when they talk about what the average like price of a gallon of gas is. It's always way more for where we live.
$9 is the cheap first screening of the day at 10 a.m. bargain matinee at the AMC Century City.
Right.
At the AMC Burbank in the mall, it's like $7.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first cheapy screening of the day.
And a lot of theater chains don't even do the first cheapy screening anymore.
Oh, I know. Now, if you live over in Silver Lake, which is the beginning of the east side of Los Angeles, if you live over there and you go see a movie, a first-run movie at, like, the Vista,
yeah,
those tickets are, like, $6.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, the Vista's is independent theater.
Cheap tickets.
They do it their way.
And that's nice.
Yeah.
But that's twice as much driving time for where you and I live. So right. I just think, I'll spend the $3 more and go to Century City where it's a 10-minute drive on a Saturday morning.
Yeah.
But I had no idea that the whole rest of the country was like, woohoo, $9 tickets. Like,
so expensive.
I am now so used to going to see a movie at the Grove or the Arclight and paying $15, $16, $17, $18 for a ticket.
Or if you're going to see Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk
in
4K, 3D.
$22.
$22. I know, I'm still reeling about that one. And you didn't even save for the whole movie.
I walked out. That's how bad that was hurting my face. The eyes in my face were about to start crying and fall out onto the floor of the Cinerama Dome.
You didn't mind throwing that money in the street.
I threw that money in the street. I got up at minute 55. I didn't see the Beyonce, the part that was fake Beyonce.
Beyonce's back.
I didn't see the strobe parts. Mm-hmm. I went across the street to Amoeba record store and I just browsed happily. I performed a task for you while I was there, but it was a fruitless task.
Oh.
I looked and looked and looked through the entire box.
Yes.
I looked through the entire box of Christmas records.
45s.
They have Christmas albums, and then they have a box of 45s, of 7-inch singles, Christmas stuff, vintage Christmas record. Because I was looking for the Holy Grail that you need.
Mm. Fran Alexander's Christmas Everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. Recorded in 1958 for a tiny little regional label in Indiana called Emerald Records. I have never found any other Fran Alexander recordings, but she had that sort of like 50s jazz singer lady kind of voice. And it was the song used over the closing credits
of Christmas Again.
Of an indie film that came out, what, last year?
Last year, which is screening on Netflix if you want to see it, if you want to hear this song. But see the movie. The movie's also great.
The movie's really good.
Yeah.
And that song over the closing credits is this like sprightly little thing.
Yeah.
And you went on a hunt for it, and you found a sound file on the internet.
There are the hardcore Christmas music experts out there. So yes. I tweeted a couple of them, and somebody sent it to me. And so I had it in my iTunes.
And then it disappeared from your iTunes.
And then iTunes ate it, because iTunes can do that, apparently.
Right.
When you click agree, you agree to all kinds of things, including iTunes randomly eating sound files that you got from somebody on the internet.
Yes.
So, I need that. I wish I'd known that you were going to go through that box, because the other, well, you would have snagged it if you'd seen it, I'm sure.
What are you looking for?
Al Hurt.
They didn't have that.
Okay.
No. Whatever it was, there was no Al Hurt.
Okay. Al Hurt recorded his own version of Hooray for Santa Claus from Santa Claus Conquers the Martians.
Yeah, no, I would have. That would have been an immediate.
Because that's got a wicked horn section, that song.
You sound just like a,
yeah, I know.
A Wicked Horn section.
Totally,
right,
yeah.
Now.
Anyway, Al Hurt plays the crap out of it, and I would like that 45 at some point.
That's probably much easier to find.
Than Fran Alexander, probably, yes.
Al Hurt was a famous person.
Yeah, this was a nationally released thing. This Fran Alexander single was apparently regional or something.
No, yeah, it was. Back in the day, there were regional record labels, and right. You could have a regional hit on local and radio stations in the surrounding counties.
Right.
And back before Clear Channel owned all the radio stations, local music directors and program directors, they had a say in what happened.
What they would play.
And audiences would call the radio station and say, hey, I like that record. Play more of that record. Or why don't you start playing this other record? Like, the world was a little different. Back then,
record labels had to bribe individual DJs. Yes. It was very time-consuming. Now, they just go to Clear Channel.
Right. The bribes all go to one spot now.
Exactly.
But the world used to be very different back before corporations owned your ass.
All the media, yeah.
Every single thing about your life is owned by a corporation.
Right.
Now, except this. No corporation owns us. And that's why we are...
Hand me that can of Folgers, won't you?
That's what. That's why we are a medium popular niche audience podcast.
Yes, with a Patreon page.
With a Patreon page. What movie would you like to talk about first?
Well, no,
How about let's talk about the one that we are not going to go see at all.
Oh, what, Incarnate?
Incarnate. It opened on like 1,500 screens or something this weekend.
Yeah, it's...
It made, I think, $15
weekend. It's from like Blumhouse apparently has a sort of spin-off label or something called like Blumhouse Tilt or something.
What does that mean?
I don't know, but as I sent Sam Fragoso to review it for The Wrap, and he pointed out that the main Blumhouse Twitter account... It does not mention this movie at all.
I don't get it. But it's their company.
Well,
why wouldn't they have
a separate Twitter account for BH Tilt. You'd think the big guys would want to promote it. Nope. This is a movie that was supposed to open in September. It kind of just snuck out now right after Thanksgiving. It's apparently terrible. And it was at a solid 0% on Rotten Tomatoes last time I looked.
Hang on. Here are the stats. I just pulled it up.
Okay.
It opened on 1,737 screens.
Woo.
It grossed this weekend $2,659,000. According to the Box Office Mojo, it cost $5 million to make.
What's the per screen on that?
$1,500 per screen.
That's not good.
No, that's not good. But it doesn't star anybody, really.
Aaron Eckhart.
Well. Now I have a theory. Now I know why. I know why.
The caged bird sings.
Someone who had the power does not like Mr. Eckhart and is trying to get Mr. Eckhart. And based on reports that I've heard around this town, he deserves it.
Allegedly.
Not because he's committed any crime.
No.
But apparently he's just kind of a dick. That's the word on the street.
Yes. We have
he's
no
not a nice person.
Firsthand knowledge of this, but
allegedly he's not nice.
Word is out.
Yeah. So I have no idea if that's what happened.
Maybe it just sucks.
But in my fantasy brain,
right. The conspiracy.
In my fantasy mind, that's what happened.
Hmm. And then, but there was also, I know some people were probably wondering why we're not talking about Believe, which is both a Christmas movie and a Christian movie.
Yeah.
We're getting to it, I promise.
Well, you...
At least I will. Dave...
I haven't decided yet if I want to go see this, and I know that might surprise the listeners who look to me... For the definitive word on the current conservative evangelical cinema, because I follow it, no pun intended, religiously. frankly, currently, I've got some beef with conservative evangelical Christians.
You're in no mood for their shenanigans.
I'm currently not in the mood for it. Mm. As many people who listen know, I grew up in a conservative evangelical world. At times, deep in a fundamentalist version of that world, and since leaving / being kicked out way back in the day, in the late 80s, I have had an academic interest in it, a fascination by it, and, you know, an insider's perspective on it for all these years. But I know that like 85% of y'all voted for Donald Trump, and I'm have had it with you. I don't care about your silly little movies right now. Did I just yell too hard into the microphone?
It was fine.
It was okay? It was okay. All right. Sorry if I hurt anybody's ears. But, yeah, we're not, we got a problem. You, all, and me. Right now, and I'll take you all on one by one if I gotta.
Well, I'm gonna try and see Believe just for my.
Might go with you just because it's playing at the Burbank Mall, and you know how much I love the Burbank Mall.
I
bet it's all decorated in a real janky way for Christmas.
Yes.
Plus, there's the tamale house. There's the the mom and pop tamale place
now,
across from the theater.
Did they?
So it might not be a bad Wednesday morning.
Did they take out the Dairy Queen?
They moved the Dairy Queen.
Okay.
The Dairy Queen that was right next to the AMC Burbank 8.
Because they're expanding the 8.
They're renovating it.
They're renovating it.
You sit in the seats now, and they're those reclining seats.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, because Robbie and I, friend / linoleum listener, Robbie and I, went to see the last Christian movie, whatever the hell that was called, at the Burbank 8. I'm blanking on what it was. Oh, it was the Columbine movie.
Oh, right. Yeah, I'm not ashamed.
I'm not ashamed. Yeah, you should have been ashamed of that movie. Sucked. And, but we were there for I'm Not Ashamed on the very first day that people were allowed to go into the new renovated seats.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, as the renovation takes place, Dairy Queen is being moved out.
Like into the food court or?
I don't know. They're moving somewhere else into the... It would behoove them to be in the food court.
Yeah.
The fact that they were not in the food court, only sort of food court adjacent, has always
been
strange.
Did them no favors.
Strange to me. The only thing that was good about it is that it was convenient because you could walk right out of the movie theater and...
And into a peanut butter parfait.
And into a dilly bar.
Mm.
Yeah. I wish... You know what I wish for that Dairy Queen? I wish they would expand... When they move to the new location in the mall.
Oh, and have a brazier?
I want them to have, like, the Hunger Buster burger and stuff. Mm. The old... everything you used to be able to get at the Dairy Queen in Texas.
Right.
Because in Texas, Dairy Queen is a walk-in, sit-down, fast-food place with an entire menu of stuff.
Oh, yeah, no, we had those in Georgia, too. Like one very near my house where we grew up, in fact.
Yeah.
At the far end of
the... And in small Texas towns, Dairy Queen is like... The city center.
Well, yeah, totally.
That's the place where you just would go.
That's one of the few good things in the movie Texasville, Peter Bogdanovich's not great sequel to Last Picture Show. But yeah, the idea of the Dairy Queen as the hub
the city.
Of activity.
Yeah, yeah. That was the social meeting center of the city, whatever town you lived in. And, you know, you lived in Kermit or Laredo or Fritch or any of those little, all the West Texas towns, you know, Happy.
Mm.
I've been to all those places.
We had
Plainview.
In East Point, Georgia, we had the Dairy Queen that was at the far end of the shopping center.
Yeah.
So it was like the Dairy Queen at the end of the parking lot, and then next to it was the A&P, where I used to go shopping with my mom before the Big Star came in.
Yes.
And then a bit further down in that shopping plot. Yeah.
Did Alex Chilton own it? Was that like his chain of grocery stores?
There was a southern chain of grocery stores called Big Star. Seriously. And so later when that... And I assumed the band named themselves after the grocery store. I didn't know. You know, you fixate on whichever Big Star comes into your life first, I guess. Then further in on the shopping plaza, you have what became the legendary Mr. V's figure eight.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very popular. Yes. Black disco of the 1970s.
Yes.
And then at the other far end was the Westgate Triple,
mm-hmm.
which closed at some point during my childhood. But as a little kid, I remember going there a bunch. And it was like one big screen on one side and two smaller ones on the other side. And that was like that one and Greenbrier Mall. Those were like, those were my movie theaters I could conceivably walk to.
Okay, so here's what's going to happen. For the sake of Christmas.
Yes.
And married togetherness. I will go with you on Wednesday.
All right.
To watch Believe. But I'm going to need... I'm going to need a Cinnabon. I'm going to need the tamales.
We're going to Burbank it up.
I need the tamales after the movie. I might want to go over to that IKEA.
For some meatballs?
Who knows
the,
what?
Who was just talking about the frozen cake?
What?
When we were talking about IKEA last night, and I mentioned meatballs, and then Amy said frozen cake. And I'm like, what? Apparently that's a thing.
Frozen cake.
Yes.
I don't know anything about that.
We have to investigate.
Amy gave me a great... I need to say two things about Amy Nicholson.
Mm-hmm.
One of the country's best film critics, by the way.
Sure.
We're about to talk about Jackie. And if you have not read Amy Nicholson's review of Jackie, she writes for MTV News. It is the best review of Jackie that I have read. And I read it twice. And I told her last night the same thing that I'm going to say to all of y'all. It is so smart. Reading it made me feel like I was getting smarter. She's so good. I mean, she's good all the time. But this review is so well written. It's one of the best film reviews I've read in months.
I enjoy reading Amy. I disagree with Amy. With some frequency.
I know you do, but I don't care about your little opinions right now.
I know.
No,
and I'm not saying that as a pejorative. I'm just saying, like, I like reading her stuff, but I was going to go, that's an interesting take. It's not my take. But,
I got a wonderful compliment from Amy last night. After I complimented her on her Jackie review, I was cooking. I was making dessert for dinner, and I opened up my spice drawer.
Go on.
I needed cinnamon to put into the dessert that I was making. Mm. I opened up the spice drawer, and she said, I've never seen anything more beautiful. I had just arranged all of my spices in the spice drawer alphabetically so that I could keep track of them. I've got too many spices in the spice drawer now that I was having a hard time finding everything quickly when I was making something, and so I alphabetized them. It only took 15 minutes my day. It wasn't like a day-long project. It was just a thing I did to help me organize my life a little better in the kitchen. And she praised my spice drawer, and I felt very validated by that.
When Pilar's parents got married,
yes,
I gave a jokey toast at the rehearsal dinner in which I implied that Susan was the sort of person who alphabetized her spice rack.
That's why Susan and I get along so well. Your sister-in-law and I are tight
for these reasons. Will be very amused to learn... that I, too, have married the sort of person who would alphabetize a spice drawer.
You did marry the person who would alphabetize a spice drawer. And you know why you did? Because you want food made well and efficiently. You want dinner on time. And that helps me get the dinner ready on time.
I want the faint essence of cardamom.
Yeah, you do. No, but I felt like, Amy likes my spice drawer.
I had a full day of Amy yesterday because the LA Film Critics voted, which was fun.
Yeah.
It was one of the most entertaining meetings I think I've ever had. Like, there was no shouting at each other. Like,
we're going to get to the movies here in a bit. I don't know when, but eventually.
It's coming up.
Talk about the LAFCA voting.
Sure, yeah. No.
LA Film Critics voted
yesterday.
Yesterday. You are a member of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association.
I am.
I am not.
There was no crazy drama, no people yelling at each other. I mean, not that there always is, but some, we've had our moments, certainly.
There have been people yelling at each other in the...
One or both of those people aren't around anymore.
Wait, let me guess. I'm not going to guess on the mic.
Yes, let's not.
But I know who one of them is for sure. I know who one of them is.
And I personally was thrilled about just about everything we picked. I mean, like, there were some ones that I might have chosen differently and some films I wish that I liked that I wish more people had seen or had been excited about. But it got when in all of the runoffs, I either liked both movies or I liked one of them, and the one that I liked won.
What I don't know what won anything. I forgot. You told me yesterday, and I've already forgot.
Okay, we gave Moonlight picture, director, supporting actor, and cinematography. Best actor was Adam Driver in Patterson. Best actress was Isabelle Huppert in Elle and Things to Come.
Right.
Supporting actor was Mahershala Ali for Moonlight. Supporting actress was Lily Gladstone for Certain Women.
And she deserved it. We were talking about that all the way back when Certain Women was released.
Yes.
And I remember telling you, if you guys, you LAFCAs,
yes,
don't give her Best Supporting Actress, then I'm done with all of you.
Yes.
Including maybe you.
Clearly that threat works.
So thank you for obeying me.
Best screenplay to The Lobster. Score for La La Land. Foreign film was The Handmaiden. Editing to O.J. Made in America. Documentary to I Am Not Your Negro. Animated film is Your Name, which is doing its awards run in L.A. this week, but we'll talk about it when it actually opens for real in 2017. It's great. That was one of the last films I saw, and I really loved it. And we're giving the career achievement to Shirley MacLaine, which we already announced. We and a special citation for TCM for their work in preserving films and making them available to people now via Filmstruck. The experimental award went to the Illinois Prophecies. Is that what it's called?
Well, now you're making me forget.
Okay. Well, yeah.
Experimental doc.
Yeah, this is all online. You can go find it there. So yeah, no, it was great. And you know, it's hilarious because it used to be a thing. I remember back in the pre-Twitter days where like there were a couple publicists.
The Illinois Parables.
The Illinois Parables. Yeah. Sorry, I was close. Yeah. Back in the day, there were a couple of publicists I knew who would always be like, well, call me when you're on your way back from the meeting and tell me who won, you know. And so, like, every year I would go, like Robert and I would go, he would drive, I would have my little crappy cell phone, and I would call them and read them the list of stuff. And now we tweet it as we go, and, you know, a lot of entertainment websites cover it as we go.
Yes.
And some of those entertainment websites still get mad because we break for lunch.
How dare you?
Too bad. We break for lunch.
How dare you do anything,
yes,
except vote? You should all have little catheters inserted into your pee areas.
Feed bags.
To collect your pee. And you should all be fed by tube during... you shouldn't eat at all. You should spend 7 to 10 hours, yes, there.
Fasting and reflecting.
Hungry and with no drink in your hand. No water. No food. Only that will satisfy Jeffrey Wells, who is a turd. I've never even met the man. I've just read him. And I read him delightedly, by the way. I need to say that. When I read him, I'm laughing all the way. Ha, ha, ha. Because he's hilarious. But not in the way that he's intentionally funny. He's hilarious because he's so disgusting. And his, first of all, he called out Jen Yamato. He said something about the Jen Yamato crowd voting for all the PC movies. Yeah.
Was it a slog? A PC?
I don't know.
Something.
I don't know. But he used it in reference to Mahershala Ali, the word PC. So that's code for someone black.
Right. Or of color in general, because I think Lily Gladstone got that one too.
He used the word, this was very, very funny to me. He used the word perversity, describing LAFCA as perverse and describing, quote, the perversity of LAFCA. And every time he used the word perversity, the film in question was something LGBT related or the performance that he was discussing was LGBT related. So that's another code word.
Does he even know he's doing it?
I don't care if he knows what he's doing or not.
I'm going to suggest
that he doesn't know that he's doing it. Simply because he's one of those like older dudes who just uses language like that unreflectively.
Right.
Anyway, it's funny. The word foo-foo came up a lot, or at least once or twice, again, in relation to a queer-themed thing.
Right.
You tell me what people's words mean. They have definitions. So, he cracks me up, that guy. I read him all the time. He's happy. He should be happy that I'm clicking.
Well, I think
it's funny to me.
I think a lot of his stuff is designed in the way that, you know, what's his face? Perez Hilton made his fortune by people who hated him clicking on his site and leaving comments.
I don't hate him at all. I just think he's funny.
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying, yeah. I think that Wells's bread is buttered as much by people who read him aghast as by who take him seriously.
Yeah. So I'm sure. Like I say, he should be happy I'm reading and clicking.
Like, people who don't like this show, they just stop listening.
Right.
No one's hate listening to this show.
Well, there was that one guy that listened to a whole year before he quit. Like, it was an incremental dislike.
I guess.
Over the course of a year. After 1 year, I couldn't deal with it anymore.
I snapped. No, that's not a quote.
Please come back. We miss you.
Give us
some constructive notes. We'll try to do better.
Okay, so Jackie, then.
It's about Jackie Kennedy.
It's about Jackie Kennedy. It is specific.
You tell what it's about.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, it is specifically about Jackie Kennedy, just before and then in the immediate aftermath of the JFK assassination. And it is a portrait of a woman who has to ensure her husband's place in history as the clock is ticking. And the way to do that is by giving him a funeral and a burial with a great amount of pomp, and to begin talking to journalists and sort of laying the groundwork for this historical context and this legacy for a presidency that lasted, you know, a little over 2 years.
2 years, 10 months.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Natalie Portman plays Jackie Kennedy and approximates the way in which we know that Jackie spoke, at least in a public context.
Hello?
Hello?
Who's this?
Who's this?
An old Sandra Bernhard routine about Marilyn Monroe calling the JFK White House.
Which one were you? Were you Marilyn or Jackie?
With not knowing is the point of the joke. I did watch this movie a second time because the first time I saw it, I was kind of cold on it. I'm still not as into it as Amy or you or a lot of other critics have been. But I think there's some interesting stuff there. I do like this. I am interested in the idea of this woman who literally in the course of a few days has to like figure out who's mourning, but also very mindful of this kind of ongoing legacy of how history will think of her husband, mm-hmm. and having to kind of create this show around his funeral to sort of cement that reputation. But I find the performance a little, I never crossed that line where I stopped seeing Natalie Portman, you know. So it's kind of weirdly impersonative, and then a little. I mean, it's weird to say that it's mannered, because the thing about Jackie always came off as mannered too, you know.
And that is not what makes it good necessarily, but what makes it interesting. Mm. And this was something that was in Amy's review: is that it's a film about constructing a shield. It's a film about artifice. It's a film about being polite and having a public face and a private face. And you can see Natalie Portman acting. You can see Natalie Portman constructing that persona around herself. And one of the things that Amy was saying is that she doesn't actually find Natalie Portman all that appealing as an actor. Just, you know, over the course of her body of work. And while I have different feelings about Natalie Portman, I think she's fine. I don't have strong feelings in any direction about Natalie Portman. I just take it on a movie-by-movie basis. But Amy's words were, it's a film about a mannequin played by a mannequin. Which was not necessarily an insult.
No, I know.
It's about, she's really the right person to play Jackie. Because she exhibits so many similar qualities. I like the movie. The period details are really nice.
Mm-hmm. The score is great.
The score is really cool.
That was our Lafka runner-up.
It's this kind of woozy score where you feel like someone's living their waking nightmare, and that's what is happening to her.
Composed by Micah Levy, who did the Under the Skin.
Under the Skin, yeah.
Yeah.
So she's an interesting composer.
Yeah.
The other thing I liked about the film was that there was a lot of strange framing going on. The cinematography is interesting to me here, in that so much of it is this sort of Kubrickian symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll cut to extreme close-ups of her, of Billy Crudup, of just about everybody. There's so much close-up work in this film that you feel confronted by them the entire way through.
I think I would have found that more effective had I not just seen in the last year Son of Saul.
Right.
Where you got the guy at the center of the frame all the time. And frankly, Billy Lynn does that a lot too.
Billy Lynn does that a lot also, yeah.
There's a lot of heads. and then the sort of, you're right, there is the kind of symmetry. There's some interesting supporting performances. I'm not crazy about Peter Sarsgaard as Bobby Kennedy. Some people adore him. Here's my thing.
Peter Sarsgaard always seems like a gay villain to me. It doesn't really matter what film he's in or who he's playing. I just think of him as kind of like a gay animated Disney villain.
The thing that drives me nuts lately, and I've been seeing it quite a bit, and when we talk about Silence, we'll talk about it. The intermittent accents. And
who's?
Sarsgaard. Because he's playing Bobby Kennedy, and you get the impression where he'll be talking and he's just doing the Peter Sarsgaard voice, and then at some point in the middle of the sentence he'll remember, shit, I'm playing Bobby Kennedy.
Clean podcast? Yeah. What did you just say?
I gotta say.
Yeah.
And then he thinks, wait, apartment. You know, he'll just sort of throw something in to kind of like tide you over.
Right. Are you getting your time?
I'm timing, yes.
At what time in the podcast did you say the swear?
Straight up 38 minutes.
You sweared so well.
You do it way more often than I do.
I do. I do, but I do it intentionally. You slipped it.
Wow.
We're a clean podcast for children and their families.
Yes, yes.
All the children of the world and all the mothers and all the fathers.
All the children who want to hear about the new Pablo Larraine movie about Jackie Kennedy.
So I'm mostly pro this film. I see what's wrong.
Yeah.
I see that there's a lot of weird disconnect going on. I see it doesn't feel fully realized, but there are elements of it that I like so much.
Yeah, I mean, I'm ultimately a juicy red tomato on this one because, you know, it does some interesting stuff. I like the notion of how history is molded in the moment.
Yeah.
I love seeing Greta Gerwig playing a period character.
Someone wanted you to know that she also did that in House of the Devil. Because that's set in the 80s.
That's true. Yeah. Well, and she does it in 20th Century Women also. She plays a 70s character. But lately, she has become so much the woman of the moment that it's interesting to see her transposed into another moment, you know?
Yeah.
Any movie that casts Beth Grant as Lady Bird Johnson,
right?
I love a little, you know.
I was appreciative of the inclusion of the fact that she wouldn't take off that blood splattered dress
yes.
for quite a while.
I want them to see what they've done.
I want them to see what they've done. And here's a thing about history that I did not know, that I had never really, somehow it had slipped right past me.
What's that?
But in those 2.5 years, 2 years, 10 months that he was president, in Texas, there were wanted posters going around with JFK's face on them.
I can't believe that you lived in Dallas, Fort Worth, as long as you did and yes. never went to the Sixth Floor Museum.
I never went to the Sixth Floor Museum, no.
Did you not have anybody visit that you could take? Because I didn't go until my dad came to town once, but
no,
I did go.
I just never got around to it.
Well, when in Dallas, visit the Sixth Floor Museum to find out more about the JFK assassination and about the context in which it took place, including the wanted posters that were around Texas by right-wing yokels who had various problems with Kennedy, from his Catholicism to his, you know, perceived communism.
Yeah, yeah. So I thought, even though it was filmed, you know, before the current madness, during which we have now elected an evil and incompetent human being to the White House.
Despicable opposition in politics never goes out of style.
I know, but the parallels to the Obama in the crosshairs imagery that I've seen over the past 8 years
yes.
is not lost on me. No. So, yeah, I didn't realize that that was a literal thing back then. Somehow history... that little nugget of historical information eluded me.
Gotcha. Yeah.
That's but you know, the movie's
pretty good. Yeah,
yeah,
I'll buy that.
What else is there? Oh, Things to Come.
Ooh, so good. The other Isabelle Huppert movie that
yeah.
Lafka and New York Film Critics both gave her Best Actress, and both listed L and Things to Come.
So Isabelle Huppert won the Lafka Award for Best Actress for L and this film.
Correct.
And that was specifically
yes.
noted.
Yes.
Okay, good. Because L is the one that's making everybody talk.
Mm-hmm.
But I want people to notice this one.
Absolutely.
This one is radically different from L. The performance is completely different.
Although she does have a cat in both movies.
She has a cat in both movies, but she has a symbolic cat, a meaningful narrative cat, in Things to Come. And Things to Come opened this week on about 3 or 4 screens.
I think New York, LA maybe, yeah,
San
but
Francisco.
It'll hopefully be getting out there. I mean, actually there are, you could sit down and map out a handful of parallels between the two characters.
You could. A few.
Yeah. But this is the latest from, apparently, because of that slash through the O, it's Mia Hansen-Løve.
Okay.
I was told.
Listen, French. you and me, we have a complicated relationship. You're a beautiful language, and I can never pronounce you properly. Her name, to me, is Mia Hansen-Løve.
Fine.
Sorry.
Louvre? I don't know.
I'm not going to be very good at
but
that.
But that's not a French thing. Like that O with a slash in it, that's some Scandinavian something.
But she is French, though.
I don't know.
Is she not?
I don't know.
She's married to Olivier Assayas.
Yes.
And you
didn't he used to go out with, you know,
Maggie Cheung?
Yeah. She's not French.
True. You're right about that. I just thought she was always French. She made Eden.
Maybe
the movie about, basically, that's all about Daft Punk.
Maybe she's like French, but her parents were born in Denmark or something. I don't know.
Possibly. This is fascinating.
Isn't it? Anyway, so Things to Come. Isabelle Huppert plays a philosophy teacher. And over the course of the film, she finds herself essentially stripped of many of the things that give her her identity. Her husband moves out to go live with his mistress. Her children grow up and leave home. Her publisher doesn't want to put out her textbook or her series of like essays anymore. They want something flashier and, you know, more accessible.
They redesign her classic textbook, and she thinks it's ugly. It looks like a package of M&Ms.
Yeah, they put like this awful like kind of rainbow explosion on the cover. You know, and so it's like, so then what? You know, and it's a thing of just her kind of persevering and carrying on. And, you know, she still has her work. She loves teaching and she's still brilliant. And, also her mother has to go into assisted living. The mother's played by the great Edith Skobe.
Yeah.
From Eyes Without a Face and Holy Motors.
And
Summer Hours.
And Summer Hours, directed by
Olivier Assayas. Oh, right. Yes, I forgot about that. This is a very, you know, evenly pitched tale of somebody going through some crap and getting out okay.
You're going through some crap. You're getting out okay. I think you're underselling it.
Okay.
Yeah. This may be one of my favorite films of the year.
Well, it's one of mine, too, for reasons I was going to get to. But why am I underselling it?
Well, I feel like the... I feel like you're underselling the depth of feeling that exists in this movie.
Oh, well, yeah, okay.
It's not just that she's going through some crap and getting through it okay. Her entire life is being pulled out from under her,
mm-hmm.
in ways that are predictable, such as the kids growing up and getting married and having their own children, and the mom eventually, you know, passing away.
Right.
And okay, that's kind of a spoiler, but not much of one. You think it's probably coming.
The writing's on the wall.
The minute you meet Ms. Scope, you're like, okay. Her favorite student, who she has a lot invested in. It's not even a romantic investment.
No.
She has intellectually invested in this student who is now a young man.
Her protege.
And he is separating from her ideologically, going off on his own, having his own ideas, which is normal.
Sure, yeah.
You know, if you are someone's intellectual mentor when they're young, it is highly likely that they will eventually depart in some way. They will veer off from your way of thinking and develop their own ideas.
And they're
not going to be your acolyte forever.
Right. And if you're a good teacher, they're doing it because of what you taught them about independent thought and you know, pursuing their own.
And they're not, I mean, it's not like they this
clash
is the
bitterly.
This is the last day of our acquaintance. No, they stay connected.
Yeah.
But she realizes, she knows that she will never have that influence over him again.
Right.
And then, of course, the biggie, the husband.
Hmm.
And it gives it the most devastating moment for me in the film is the minute he tells her, I've been seeing someone else, I'm leaving you. And it comes out of absolute left field for her. And she sits down and very plainly says, I thought you'd love me forever. I think like the wind knocked out of her.
That's a really powerful moment. But then at the same time, though, when you look at their relationship as it was portrayed up until that point, she doesn't seem to like him that much.
What are you talking about?
Well, you know, when you know, she's when they're like when the student comes over for dinner and she seems to be kind of dismissive about him and his interests. And I don't know. I mean, it was almost more like she was more attached to the stability of being in this long-time marriage with him than being in love with him or being loved by him. So while she does have that feeling in that moment, in general, it's like, I don't know that this relationship was entirely built in that way, you know?
Maybe.
What I love about this movie, especially because right now, you know, like I said, LA Film Critics voted yesterday. So in the weeks coming up to the voting meeting, a lot of studios shove us into these last-minute screenings of their big middle-brow end-of-the-year la-di-da award movies. And
so much la-di-da.
So much la-di-da. Yeah. And the thing is, when you see a movie like Things to Come, where there's not this sort of clearly delineated three-act structure, and there's no villain, and there's no... It's not this series of events, and then this happens to her, and then that happens to her, and then she goes here, and then that. And that.
Small. It's very small in that, you know, quotidian sort of.
Yeah,
incidents.
little
everyday life-size small moments,
bites of revelation.
They become meaningful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It just makes you realize how much every movie you see in the theater is the same thing, or is at least so similar, you know. And even even indie films really just kind of hew to this formula of how movies are supposed to be written and how stories are supposed to be told. And so you see a film like this that is so assured and so confident in its smallness and so powerful in its, you know, quotidian nature.
There's an everydayness to it that by virtue of being absent from most screens is very powerful.
I mean, I might even like it better than L, frankly.
Well, L is a grandiose, perverse.
I mean, yeah, they're apples and oranges in a lot of ways.
And it's about, you know, big terrible things. L. This movie is about small terrible things.
I mean, I like L too. Don't get me wrong. But yeah, I was really blown away by this.
Yeah, I love it. I love it, and her performance is just as real and committed and daring in a way as her performance in L. Because she is giving you, you know, you're not seeing something big here. You're seeing an interior performance. There are moments where there's a moment in the film where all she's doing is looking out the window of a car as her husband is driving.
Right.
And the look of pain and grief on her face, and it's the camera just holds on her doing that.
And nostalgia.
Incredibly moving. So go see this.
Yes.
If you can.
Things to Come.
Go see this one.
Not to be confused with the 1930s science fiction film.
Right. You got a DVD you want to talk about?
Scream Factory is putting out a brand new Blu-ray of Bob Clark's Black Christmas, the early 70s seminal holiday slasher film. A very creepy movie in its own right, but I think kind of interesting in that, Bob Clark would then later go on to make A Christmas Story, his other holiday movie, and then also the fact that a decade or so before Halloween, this was a holiday-based slasher movie that really, you know, Halloween is definitely the template for the slasher film of the early 80s, but Black Christmas sets a lot of that in motion.
Oh, you know?
It's sort of the connector between, say, like Psycho and Peeping Tom and Halloween.
That voice still freaks me out.
Yes, very creepy. So that's worth checking out. Incidentally, speaking of A Christmas Story and Black Christmas and such, TCM is rerunning a documentary called A Night at the Movies, Merry Christmas.
That features
me.
You.
With a bunch of other people, too.
Come on. Who are those other people anyway?
Bunch of nobodies, like, you know, Joe Dante and Chevy Chase.
Yeah, whatever about them.
Carolyn Grimes, who played Zuzu in It's a Wonderful Life.
You.
And Margaret O'Brien from Meet Me in St. Louis.
And
Julie Salomon. And
also you.
And the dude who does I blanking on his name, the annotated Christmas Carol guy, who's amazing.
All of them are not as great as you.
Oh, that's very sweet, but that's not true. Anyway, they just...
I'm not making dinner for any of them.
you're right
I wouldn't organize my spice drawer for any of those
people.
You are
right about that.
Yeah.
They just ran it over the weekend, and then it's showing two more times this month. So if you go to tcm.com and look at the month schedule, it's called A Night of the Movies, : Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas in your :
Yeah, so check that out.
The Milestone Film and Video just put out a Blu-ray. The Magic Box. The films of Shirley Clarke, 1929 to 1987.
Now, this is part of a larger series?
It is. It is. This is Project Shirley Volume 4.
Huh.
Yeah. Shirley Clarke is an underrated filmmaker of the 20th century.
Probably best known for Portrait of Jason.
Her legacy is sort of undertold.
Mm.
And I personally have only recently come to even know who she is. I generally consider myself to be fairly, you know, aware of, you know, a bit of film history, and she's relatively new to me, and so I'm very excited. It's a three disc set. The first disc is all of her experimental films. The second disc is her dance, some of her dance films. Mm. And the third disc has Robert Frost, A Lover's Quarrel with the World, Christopher and Me, and her home movies.
Whoa.
So this is very cool, and I'm very excited that it's happening. And after Christmas, I get to dig into this and have a little free time to watch these discs alongside the Kung Fu movies that they show on the El Rey Network, which is always my post-Christmas treat for me, myself.
I love some good archival stuff. And that's, I mean, one of the interesting things about the cinema is that...
Say it again, just like that.
Cinema.
Yeah.
There's always a new corner to explore. You know, just when you think you've seen... The things that you need to have seen, there's always more that you have not
seen.
Someone
says, hey, by the way, have you seen this? Because you needed to already have seen this.
Right.
Right. I don't... It's an
endless process.
Yeah, I will never say that I've seen everything I need to see or that I know everything I need to know,
and
obviously.
No one does. Right. Even the people we know who are super versed in this stuff, there's always going to be some new corner of things that they don't know about and should. So,
right.
There you go. Do we have letters?
We do.
Woo!
Allow me to pull some of them up for you.
I would. Why not? Should I pause?
Hang on. No, I got it. This is from Clint. Hey, David Alonzo. I saw Alonzo's review of Inferno on What the Flick. This is a letter from October.
Mm.
And I'm surprised he liked this movie.
Okay, I was entertained by this movie, which is not the same as liking it. Let's be very clear about that.
Right, right. He says, as a moviegoer, I thought it was poorly directed.
Yes.
And tried to create tension where there was none.
That's part of what made it entertaining.
I love Tom Hanks, but seeing him slowly jog to evade the authorities was comical.
Yes, exactly.
It was a bit of a light jog, wasn't it?
It's a trot.
The movie doesn't trust its audience, so they had to repeat things over and over. How many times do we need to see that Gmail message? As a person who read the book... Ooh, you read the book!
Oh, well then.
I know movies based upon books shouldn't be bound by the source material, especially one
Dan
like this.
Dan Brown.
But Inferno only takes the framework of the book, it only takes the framework of the book while leaving out the most interesting parts. The book gets a bit dark. It goes more in depth of the plan to purge the population in order to make it better for the survivors, the planet, and the morality surrounding this idea. Here are just a few of the changes. And he says, spoilers for the book and movie.
I think Inferno has already left theaters, so spoil away.
Yeah. There were two groups chasing Robert Langdon in the beginning, and it wasn't clear... who could be trusted until Robert was captured by soldiers that turned out to be part of the World Health Organization? You never knew the WHO had its own soldiers. Yeah. At this point, he's introduced to Dr. Elizabeth Sinsky, head of the WHO, who explains the situation. They were never in a relationship.
Hmm.
Okay, that's the book. The Sienna twist is actually a double twist in the book.
Hmm.
She races Robert to the location to find the virus, not to release it, but to stop it, because she didn't trust the virus in the hands of the WHO, because it could end up in the hands of those trying to weaponize it. And finally, the virus was actually released 1 week before anyone found it, causing 1/3 of the world to become infected. The Moose Studio wanted a happier ending.
I'm not defending Inferno in the slightest. I mean, everything you say is true. I'm just saying I had a good time because it was so stupid, which these made it more entertaining than the first two Da Vinci Code movies, which were just dreadful.
Yeah. He says, in the end, this was a cash grab. The studio banked on the movie, making a ton of money. It didn't.
wrong.
People around the world read the books. The trailer looked terrible, but I still saw it because I wondered if the studio would stick to the original ending. They will never make Dan Brown's book The Lost Symbol because it deals with science of what happens to you when you die. Maybe they could make it if they marketed it as a religious movie. no one went to see this film, so
yep.
I don't think there are going to be any more
Robert Langdon. Dr. Robert Langdon.
Yeah. This is from Dan.
Mm-hmm. Dan Brown?
Dear,
quit making fun of my books, you guys.
Dear.
I'm a multimillionaire.
He addresses it to Dear Cuck Boss, number one, and Cuck Boss, number two.
Oh, hooray.
And then parenthetically, he adds, sorry, Alonzo, I know you hate it when Dave uses that word. But I had to, because the alt-right deserves all the mocking it can get. I love listening to Linoleum Knife, and I was wondering if you could talk more about how you approach your jobs as film critics. For instance, I'm sure that you often see movies with other film critics, especially at film festivals, and you talk about them before writing your reviews.
And no.
Hang on. let him keep going. Okay. And I get why. Talking about movies is fun, and discussion helps us understand them better. But I wonder if you think there's a downside to this practice. There are some movies which critics seem to universally love, but which don't deserve it. I wonder if those movies benefit from some groupthink, presumably created by critics reading the reviews of other critics before writing their own. Have you ever found yourselves puzzled by a movie being a critical darling which seemed unremarkable or even downright bad? Is there anything you do as film critics to avoid getting caught up in professional groupthink? Best, Dan. Please address this.
Sure, yeah. I will as well,
but you go first.
After screenings, especially at film festivals, when we are the first people to be writing about a movie, we don't talk afterwards. We all kind of like, if we see each other in the lobby, we'll sort of like nod and acknowledge each other and then run off and go file.
Yeah.
I make it a practice not to read other reviews before I have to review a movie because I don't want my judgment colored by anyone else's experience. I don't want to go into a movie thinking about, is it true that this performance isn't good or that that's great or whatever.
Yeah.
So I try to be as tabula rasa as possible. I can't speak for all critics. We all have our own practice. but that's my thing. I very much studiously avoid that. So I find it hilarious when I get accused of being
participating
in groupthink. It's like, no, I didn't. No, I shut it out. Or especially if it's a thing where, because at the Wrap, because I'm a trade publication, a lot of times I do get to be one of the first people who sees something.
Yes.
I studiously avoid jawing about it with my colleagues until we've all had a chance to write about it first.
There is, I have witnessed the standing outside the screening.
Oh yeah, you'll see some clusters.
I have seen the clusters of people standing outside screenings talking. Now, and I'm talking about film critics standing outside the screening talking. The first couple of times that I wound up in one of those groups, I realized that I was hearing other film critics give their sort of hot takes to each other. And after like the second or third time, and I mean, this was
years ago,
17 years ago, I thought, oh, I can't be a part of this because I don't want anyone telling me a thing that I go and internalize and then I have to go write. Especially if I have the same idea as someone else has, because that does happen quite a bit. You know, the same reference points, the same immediate gut reaction, the same points of comparison.
This movie reminded me of that movie.
This movie reminded me of that movie, or this movie reminded me of that cultural thing that's happening right now. And so standing in that circle of folks after a film it benefits no one. So early on, I made the conscious decision, I just can't, I just won't. Now,
you consciously uncoupled.
Having said that, if it's something like, some big mainstream piece of crap, then it's fun to stand in that group and be all like, ha, ha, ha. But I'll tell you the real reason why I don't often stand in that circle is that I have to pee. I have to go to the bathroom. The movie's over, and I've been holding it for like 20 minutes. I got to go. So, you know, even if it weren't professionally
injudicious,
unhelpful for me,
right?
I got to go to the bathroom. The worst moment and the moment that just sort of is branded in my brain, and I've talked about this on the show before, was after seeing The Purge 2. I walked out of it, and Manola was standing out in the lobby, and she saw me, and she goes, "John Carpenter rules!" And I was like, "Damn you, Manola Dargis!"
That was my joke.
That was what I had written that down in my notes. Not John Carpenter rules, but I just wrote John Carpenter. And then I thought, I can't use it because she's going to use that. And she's with the New York Times and I'm with a crappy little website that no one cares about. And then when I wrote the review, I thought, you know what? Screw it. I thought this too.
I have ideas.
I had my own idea and I wrote it in my notes and I'm putting it in my review and I don't care.
It is hard sometimes with Manola because, like, yeah, I try to avoid the clusters too, but I remember coming out of Curse of the Jade Scorpion and seeing Manola from about like 10 yards away and she just did the finger down the throat thing. She kills me.
She's a funny woman.
We gotta start planning the year in review episode with her.
So anyway, I don't do the thing. Listen, there is no concerted effort to this, and I cannot read anyone else's review of anything before I sit down to write something. Now, if I'm not reviewing it, my general tendency is not to read anyone else's review, even before I do this podcast.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I don't, like, if I'm not writing for the rap, but we haven't talked about it yet, like, I won't listen to Bibbs and Whitney talk about
it. Right, right. But if I do read someone else's review before we record this podcast, and I talk about it, I will reference.
You'll quote them. Yeah.
I will quote them like I did today with Amy.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think her review is so important that you read for Jackie that I wanted to draw people's attention to it. Like,
sure.
Go, just in general, go read Amy Nicholson. Mm-hmm. In your life, in your daily life, go read her because she's worth it.
And Manola, of course.
And of course, Manola. But I mean, you knew that already. For me, being a film critic is one part of my writing life. You know, it's not everything I do as a writer. But as a film critic, I have, I think, a responsibility to write about it in a personal way that is reflective of how, you know, a person who tries to be a thinking human being goes to the movies.
Yeah. Fair enough.
That's my approach. I'm writing about life.
Yeah.
And films are a part of life.
As our friend James...
And they're the part of life that brought you and me together.
Yeah, pretty much. As our dear friend James Rocky, who has left the biz, said memorably years ago, I write about cinema, which means I write about everything.
Yeah. I hope that answers your question, but no, me no like the group thing.
No.
Yeah. Okay, let's be done. Would you like to join our club? Sure you would like to.
Of course.
Here's what happens when you join our club. You go to patreon.com, P-A-T-R-E-O-N slash
Patreon.com/linoleum knife.
And when you join our club, you get to listen to LKTV, a podcast of the television.
Mm-hmm.
It's not bad. We talk about the TV shows we watch.
Yes.
And we behave like film critics, only we talk about TV.
And sometimes we have cool guests.
Sometimes we have guests. And it costs you money. It costs you $1 per episode, which translates into a $4 per month subscription. If you subscribe at a higher level than $4 per month, and those levels are available for you to see on Patreon.com, you get more things. So many more things. Our fiscal year is coming to a close at the end of January 2017. We began in February 2016.
Right.
And in February 2016, there will be a volume two of club membership, where things will be a little different, and things you get are going to be different. And by the end of January, all of you who subscribed are going to have all the things that you subscribed for. So do that. I want to keep these plugs as brief and quickly done as possible.
If you want to join at the going rate, do it now.
Yeah. No, the going rate is going to stay.
I guess.
It is.
Okay.
Yeah, we're not raising the rate.
No, but... Yeah, okay, fine.
But there'll be different things that you get. We're changing up some of the things that you get.
Yes.
Yeah. So,
Also, if you'd like to benefit this show and not necessarily sign up for a monthly subscription, go to our Facebook page and click on any of the Amazon links you see there, whether it's to my book, Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas, or to our DVD picks. Even if you don't buy that item...
If you're there shopping for something else on Amazon.
Yeah, if you just use that as a way to get onto Amazon while you're doing your holiday shopping,
That portal kicks back a little to us.
Yes.
Which is pretty cool.
We get a nice percentage, and we buy fiber with it. It's great. Everybody's happy.
I also bought your flaxseed oil once with that.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So it's our intestinal health
and eyes
is at stake.
Yes,
that's what's at stake here. If you want to buy a Linoleum Knife T-shirt, they are black T-shirts with the words Linoleum Knife in white across the chest. Your beautiful chest. Those are $22 payable to linoleumpodcast@gmail.com on PayPal. We have all the sizes. I think we have one men's 2X left. I think so. And so that's that. Those are all the selling pitches that we have for you right now.
If you are outside of the United States, it's going to cost a little more.
Just ask us, talk to us. Yeah. But we have like all the sizes. We have women's sizes. We got everything.
And one last thing, if you're in Los Angeles and listening to this early enough, on Tuesday, December 6th, Frank DeCaro and I will be hosting a Movie Little Christmas in Tinseltown 3 at the Council Chambers of the West Hollywood Library as part of the Outfest West Hollywood series. And it's where we show clips and talk to people involved with some of our favorite Christmas movies and TV specials. Guests this year include Brett Kelly of the two Bad Santa movies and Unaccompanied Minors, along with Unaccompanied Minors screenwriter Maya Kelly. Actress Meryl Wilson from Miracle on 34th Street, who published a memoir this year.
Not Maya Kelly.
Maya Stark, sorry.
You said Brett Kelly.
Brett Kelly, Maya Stark, sorry.
Yeah.
I don't even know what I'm saying half the time. Gregory Harrison.
That's a fact.
Yes. Gregory Harrison from The Gathering. Golden Girls expert Jim Colucci, who's been on LKTV, will be showing a never-before-seen outtake from a Golden Girls holiday episode. Our friend Kate Flannery from The Office will be talking about those Christmas episodes, as well as her collaboration with Jane Lynch on Jane Lynch's new holiday album, which is out right now. And I'm super excited about this. John Paragon, who was Jombi the Genie on Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Mecca-leca-hi-ho.
And the co-writer of the Christmas in Pee-wee's Playhouse special,
Mecca-ho-ho-ho,
will be there as well. So anyway, tickets are available at outfest.org. Or you can do walk up. We also have a game shows portion where we'll be asking you Christmas movie and TV trivia questions and giving away cool prizes. It's going to be a stone cold gas. You should be there.
At the merch table.
That's right. They will be the merch table. I will be signing some books afterwards. So hope you can come to that. And in the meantime, check out.
Don't think flirting with me is going to get you a discount either.
No.
No.
cover price.
Right.
Check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Listen to the Rotten Tomatoes podcast and B-Movies podcast and Cancel Too Soon with the Bibbs and Whitney, the Dennis Anyone podcast with Dennis Hensley, the Schmoes Know, the Comics Canon, Sewers of Paris, the Joel Ryan Thing, Fat Guys of the Movies, the Criterion Cast, Film Spotting SVU, the Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to the show for free at iTunes. Leave us some positive feedback there. It does really build an audience for us. And you can also leave us some nice reviews on all the places where we stream, including Stitcher Radio, TheLounge.com, Podbean, Satchel, and CastBox. And if you are on Android, you can get us on Google Play. Thanks to Blue for our great theme music. We always appreciate it. And you can find out more about him at Bluetopia.com, Bluetopia. Follow this program on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at LinoleumCast. And again, our email address is linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. We love hearing from you. We will be getting caught up on letters by the end of the year, we think. And
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Yes. So, thanks for listening as always. And we will catch you guys next time.
Goodbye.